believes that Thomas the Tank Engine, with real ambition in life, she can't decide. Her ambition in life is to become a tooth fairy. I have just learned that without her father's consent, this sweet, trusting six-year-old has just been sent for weekly instruction to a Roman Catholic nun. What chance has she? And the questioner asks how she turned out. She has turned out happily. She is not a religious believer. She is a rationalist. And she is doing brilliantly as a university student. And I think she'll have a brilliant career as a doctor.
Thank you. I don't know where I am with this mic.
Do you think the human overpopulation will be self-corrected, or we should take measures to remedy it?
Well, in nature, overpopulation can be self-corrected, and among the methods of self-correction are starvation and disease. Ultimately, therefore, any overpopulation will be self-corrected, if only by such drastic results. Also in nature, animal populations may be self-corrected in other ways. Sometimes reproductive rates are related to the density of the population. Sometimes natural selection actually favors reduction in breeding, not in the interests of the welfare of the entire species, I hasten to add, but in the interests of the welfare of the family. The great ornithologist David Lack, in particular, worked on this. Each species of bird has a particular clutch size, and any individual species that has more, that lays more eggs than it can rear, and is capable of finding food for, will end up rearing fewer chicks than a rival bird that lays the right number, the optimum number of eggs. So there's an optimum number which is neither too many nor too few. In the case of human populations, it is an observed fact that the more educated people are, and the more prosperous they are, the more likely they are to self-regulate their own family size. And so that rather contradicts a naive interpretation of the biological principle from David Black, whereon I think that the richer an individual was, the more they would turn their riches into children. With humans, that doesn't seem to happen. And so, as with so many other of human problems, education and increasing prosperity would be possible. And then this might offer something.
My sense is that at deep roots we're motivated and nurtured by relationships within the human realm. And that one of the appealing characteristics, obviously, of religions is a sort of animistic presence of conscious entity around us. And irrespective of whether that's true or not, my sense is that that provides a nurturing psychological backdrop. And as a materialist, I sometimes wonder, is it possible to simultaneously believe in a materialist worldview, but at the same time give yourself the illusion that there is a nurturing presence in order to benefit from that aspect? Or do you really lose that adult version of Santa Claus, which really does give children something pleasant?
It's a very important and interesting question, obviously. I think my own view is that there probably is some psychological value which is inadvertently tapped into by religion. But that psychological value can be fed, can be achieved by other things which don't have to be the Santa Claus in the sky. They don't have to be any kind of supernatural presence. I try to give my own approach to that in my book Unweaving the Rainbow, and also in the last chapter of The God Delusion, where I try to suggest that for some people, of whom I'm one, silence itself can actually give some of that satisfaction, can satisfy that psychological need which the questioner perceptively points to. Science, after all, tells us where we come from, where we're going, why we're here, what is this universe in which we have woken up and in which we are destined to go to sleep, where life comes from, why it's so beautiful, so elegant, so diverse, so relevant of a powerful illusion of design. We see nature through eyes that are opened as though the black worker had dropped away, eyes that are opened, and we see a new beauty, the beauty of understanding, something which Thomas Jefferson obviously appreciated to the full. And for me, that really does fill that gap which you might feel was there from losing the imaginary friend. Maybe different people are satisfied by different things. I also find myself satisfied by human love, the love of warm, real human beings as opposed to non-existent imaginary friends. To me, that's a lot more satisfying. The appreciation of the beauty of art, of music, of architecture, like this magnificent campus. I think all those things fill the apparent void which some people think that they need religion in order to fill. It is, of course, a worldview which is finite. We see the end of our life as really the end. I don't think that should be a terrifying thought. In some ways, the thought of going on living forever and ever and ever is far more terrifying. I, for one, am extremely happy to be a scientist in the 21st century, trying to follow in the footsteps of enlightenment figures such as Thomas Jefferson.
Going back to the previous question about population growth, I think there was a recent study that showed that the reproductive rate in Utah is something like 60% higher than that in Vermont, but that was probably certainly related to the religious beliefs in those two states. So I was wondering if, on your model of religious beliefs spreading sort of by taking advantage of another trait that has adaptive value but not being adaptive itself, do you think particular sets of religious beliefs can actually have adaptive value in a Darwinian sense, and because they're heritable, that they're actually spreading on their own accord and not just by taking advantage?
Yes, that's another very interesting question. I suppose that facts such as you've just given us would suggest that almost by definition there is a kind of natural selection going on between religious ideas. Religious ideas that are pro-reproduction, to encourage people to have lots of children, are likely to spread at a higher rate than alternative ideas that may or may not be religious, that discourage reproduction. It's another question, however, whether what we're dealing with here is genetic evolution. If you divide up the population into those who have lots of children and those who don't, and then look for any systematic genetic difference between those in the first category and those in the second, and finally, then by definition you do have Darwinian natural selection going on. But I suspect that the trends that you've discerned, the difference between the religiously inspired reproductive race in Utah and Vermont, are unlikely to be systematically correlated with genetic differences. I think what we have going on here is selection of alternative ideas rather than selection of alternative genes. It's arguably an analogy to Darwinian natural selection, but probably not true natural selection, and unlikely to give rise to true evolutionary change in the genetic sets. It is not absolutely possible.
Richard, I want to thank you for coming. Mr. Jefferson's university is not as safe as you might imagine. Within the religious fanaticism has played a role here. Within the last 10 years, we had Vice President for Health Affairs who thought it was appropriate to send a message to all the faculty urging us to increase our faith in God and urging us to regard many things that went on in the medical school as miracles. And so that the fanaticism that you see inside the United States is a real threat here. It's not, it doesn't appear to be a threat at the moment in medical school, but I think it's always ready to arise. I actually wanted to ask the same question as the previous speaker, but I was astonished in your book that you didn't address the issue of religion as a pressure for increased family size. That is, and in fact, it's monotheism that is the primary push for large families. But if you look at Mormons, Orthodox Jews, Muslim religion, and Catholicism, there's been tremendous pressure. And what is happening in Europe today, which is that all the countries in Europe are declining population, and in some countries, such as Germany, is now regarded as a crisis. Maybe a reflection of education, not education of people, but education of women, which is the primary event. And that this could have had a long-term effect, which would be genetic.
Yes. Well, thank you for that very pessimistic correction. I didn't know the story you just told me about. May I say, I hope X being that's something anyway. And your pessimistic prognosis is one that I have worried about, and there's really nothing more I can say, but thank you for alerting us and alarming us.
Short question, then maybe a little longer question. Short one is, Philip Pullman on your side, and would you replace religion with Philip Pullman and his view of anti-religion? And the other is a little more complicated. Why just stop with religion? If you're only saying that's a delusion, why not just go full and say the whole self is a delusion? A lot of cognitive scientists are coming to say that the idea that there is a self and that we're all wonderful individual selves is in fact a delusion. And shouldn't we be accepting that and getting out of the myth that we have these wonderful individual selves that are unique and lovely?
Thank you. I must say, you do a very good class of question in this place. I've been traveling around the United States, and these by far the most interesting questions that I've had. Philip Pullman is a British novelist for children, passionately against religion. His own novels are sort of a bit odd in that respect, because they bring in religious figures and angels and devils and satanic figures as the sort of the whole Christian mythology as part of the childhood fiction. He's a wonderful writer, and his books can be enjoyed by adults as much as by children. They're great epic novels. I don't wish to replace rationalism by Philip Pullman's style anti-theism, no. I think it's good fiction. I've got the second question. Just give me one word and I'll answer it. The delusion itself. Well, consciousness, what it means to be conscious, what it means to feel that I am me, is one of the most baffling things that philosophy and science has to deal with. And a number of recent scientists and philosophers have suggested, in one way or another, that the self is a delusion. The sense that I am one person who has a will, who has a desire, who has a goal, who moves around as a unity, is a delusion, it is a illusion. From a Darwinian point of view, I don't have too much trouble with that. I can easily see that natural selection could favor an animal that constructs in the brain an illusion of a unified self, which is useful for survival. So that may very well be so. I think it would be very, very hard subjectively, I think I'm allowed to face the question probably does, I think it would be very, very hard to live a human life without succumbing to the illusion that one is a self and living by it and assuming that other people are selves, assuming that other people have intentions. The philosopher Daniel Dennett has coined the phrase intentional stance. And he gives a Darwinian interpretation of it. If you are faced with a saber-toothed tiger about to spring on you, you could analyze its behavior according to what Dennett calls the physical stance. You could consider the nerve impulses traveling through its brain and about to travel down the motor nerves towards the muscles that are about to activate its legs to spring on you. But the physical stance is less immediately serviceable, is less immediately useful for high-speed action than the intentional stance, which assumes that the saber-toothed tiger is an agent with the intention of eating you and with muscles that are about to be controlled by the intentional agent inside the head of the saber-toothed tiger. And that's a simple metaphor for why Dennett thinks the intentional stance has evolved as a kind of brain strategy. Well, we all have that. We all have, if it is an illusion, we all have the illusion. And those people who don't, those people who don't think of themselves, don't feel themselves to be a single intentional individual. For example, those people who think of themselves as several different individuals, there are such people, are regarded as insane and are given psychiatric treatment. So I find myself in a very difficult state, but as a materialist, when I rationally think about what I am, I come up with a view of myself which is not entirely compatible with the view of myself that I really need in order to get through life. And I suppose there might be a comeback to that. People might say, well, then what about religious people who feel a need for God in order to get through life? I don't have a very good answer to that. I suppose the only answer is that I, in a sense, am prepared to accept that it is an illusion, but a useful illusion, whereas they don't accept that it is even an illusion at all.